It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Yeagy. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast. So glad you're here today. Today, we have a pretty fun guest. He's a wealth strategist and founder of Your Dedicated Fiduciary, YDF, we'll call it. And prior to founding YDF, he spent a decade consulting leading private wealth teams nationally at family offices, wirehouses, and registered investment advisors, and talks to them about how to allocate their high net worth clients' capital to institutional money managers. In that role, he saw firsthand that many advisors are often limited in their approach to advanced planning, and that leaves clients underserved. So he thought there was a niche and a way to serve. He's a devout advocate of the fiduciary principle. He loves macro, like I do, macroeconomics. He's based in Dallas, and he enjoys being a late-blooming parent of his two children. They're 7 and 5, and both of them who are future interns for Danielle DiMartino Booth. Let's welcome Vance Barth. Hey, Vance. Welcome.
Mark, thank you very much for having me. It is truly a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's so glad to have you here. And the first thing I want to talk about is Danielle. I'm going to start it off on a negative thing. Danielle DiMartino Booth has been talking about we're going to be going into a deflationary spiral for the last 4 years. And I'm like, no, we're not. We're in an inflationary spiral. She's like, no, it's going to be deflation. So I don't really agree with her on topics of economics, but that's what economics do, right? They create opposite ends of the spectrum. You can debate them, and then everybody's usually wrong and right at the same time. But anyway, so that's good. Do you have some kind of a relationship with Danielle?
Yeah, very much. I am truly fortunate to have her as a dear friend and life mentor of sorts. And it's actually interesting, Mark. When my 7-year-old son was born, I brought her book, Fed Up, which you can see here just off camera. And I took a photo of my newborn son in one arm and her book in the other, and I tweeted it out, catching up on a little light reading, right? And
I love it.
I received this DM and checked it, and it was a request to text the photo to this particular number, which I did, and a couple days went by, and I was like, you know, maybe that actually is Danielle. I figured it was, you know, a publicist or assistant or something.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, between you and me only, it is, in fact, my cell phone number. And that was, you know, 7 years ago. And this dialogue ensued. We became fast friends. And I'm truly, truly grateful for Danielle.
Yeah, she's a smart, very smart person and is a great author and has some great opinions. I just don't agree with her on the deflationary cycle that we're in. But, you know, whatever. That's why they make vanilla and chocolate, you know. So,
you know, that's the beauty about having economic opinions, because sometimes you can be right. It's just not right now, right?
Right, but now. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we'll see. Anyway, so talk to us about where you came from, how you started, and where we are now, how you help people.
Sure. So back in 2007, I thought it was a little unusual, living in San Diego full-time at the time, that everyone was making $350,000-some as a subprime mortgage broker. And my then boss introduced me to a gentleman named John Sunt, who had this firm, a platform of alternative investments called Altegris. And I remember he got me an interview with John. John's looking at my resume, and he looks up at me and he goes, I don't think you understand. You meet none of our criteria to be here. And polite persistence is certainly a virtue. And I bugged him for 9 months, and 9 months to the day after that first interview, he gave me a job. And that was right before the 2008 maelstrom started. And it really launched my career, because I was very fortunate to spend literally thousands of hours inside of wealth management firms and with financial advisors, learning what they do for clients. But more importantly, by way of that, realizing what they don't do for clients. So the context of it was to be in there and to teach them how to invest their high net worth clients' capital. But naturally, part of that relationship was to learn what they do for clients. So having done that for nearly a decade, I decided that I would start YDF, really to focus on the solutions and strategies that so many of the high net worth advisors don't offer, largely by way of advanced tax and estate planning.
So let's go into that. I mean, what is different between the typical investor and the high net worth investor that makes your advice different for them?
Two things. Number one, the what I call siloed business model that is idiosyncratic to wealth management. So if you imagine a circle with decline in the middle, you would have a branch where all of the insurance solutions are provided by the property and casualty agent. You would have another branch where their taxes are done, typically, I might add, on a reactive basis, because what do most CPAs do? They say, hey, Happy New Year. Here's your tax organizer. Send me everything from last year, and I'll go ahead and crunch the numbers and send you your draft return. Then you'll have the so-called wealth manager focusing on portfolio management, and the estate planner with whom they meet, what, maybe every 5 years, if that. And so I realized that the model itself really could use some enhancement. And a true family office will serve as that core hub sitting alongside of the client and orchestrating a multi-collaborative approach with all of the different members of the allied planning team. And that doesn't have to be unique for families that have north of 25 million. In my opinion, the most underserved cohort within wealth management is the 2 million to 10 million liquid profile, because they're not quite big enough to get the attention of the private wealth family offices or the big trust companies, but their needs are more expansive than the typical retail client that might have a $500,000 rollover. And the second, to answer your question, is really understanding the typical planning gaps and very specifically filling them. So for example, when families on board, the first thing I do after getting to know them is ask for the last 5 years of tax returns. And literally 100% of the time, they go, why do you want my tax returns? You're not a CPA. And I'm saying, you're right. I need the tax returns so that my team and I can look at the historical fact patterns of your tax return profile. Maybe they own real estate. Maybe they own a business. Maybe they own both. Maybe they have children. Maybe they want to keep as much of their money inside of the estate as possible. In that scenario, we're a pretty good team to know, because we can bridge that and other gaps.
Yeah, and it sounds like a more holistic approach to people's money. It starts from the tax returns, and it envelops, you know, a lot of things that people use in their financial decisions, insurance and all that kind of stuff. And it's so important, because we're not taught financial stuff in school, right? We're not taught how to handle our money. Most of us give our money over to somebody and let them handle it and hope that they're right, but they don't have the wherewithal to be able to kind of monitor them and make sure they're right. That's kind of where you come in, it seems like, and you can kind of help them. You can kind of quarterback them on their game plan. Am I correct on that?
Very much. And it's interesting. We have at least one, possibly two generations of rock star self-directed investors, right? It turns out when the Fed runs quantitative pleasing, as my friend Danielle calls it, and
I like that,
cuts rates to zero and stocks, bonds, and real estate all go to the moon over periods of time, it's very easy to buy an ETF or to buy an index mutual fund, set it, forget it, and move on. But post-2022, when that 13-ish year window of QE, ZIRP, TINA, and so forth, now that the economy has zapped back into that 3 to 3.5% inflationary environment for now, we rewind back and look at 2022, stocks got whacked, bonds got whacked, and all of a sudden people went, wait a minute, I can't just buy the Mag 7 or what I call the Nifty 9 of tech stocks. I actually need to understand a little more about what I'm doing. And that's where the value of the holistic planning can come into play. Because having just left the end of last year, December is such a great month to look at the different tax lots in a taxable portfolio to figure out things that you can do really to bring tax alpha as it relates to the client's estate. I don't want to get too technical, and it's just important to understand that year end is a very busy time because of all the planning opportunities.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of people just don't even understand the different, I mean, I don't think you should run your portfolio from a tax perspective, but you shouldn't ignore taxes either. I mean, one of my accountants in the past said, you know, there's a lot worse things than paying taxes, and he's right. But at the same time, you got to play offense, you got to score points, And you can't not score points because you're going to have to pay taxes on that. So that's the double-edged sword. But I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned, and that is maybe we have a debate on this, and that is, are we really at an inflation rate of 3.5%? I calculate over the last 4.5 years, me and ChatGPT, we had a little conversation. We calculated it's 11.1% for my lifestyle, and I don't have that fancy of a lifestyle, but you know, it's 11.1% a year. So I believe, and I want to hear what you think, that if you're not getting 11.1% in terms of purchasing power, you're actually going backwards. So 11.1% or 10 or whatever one you want to use is the new benchmark for at least breaking even. So if you're in CDs, you're getting 4.5%. You're losing 6% to inflation. If you're getting 8% in the ETF of the S&P 500, great, you're still losing to inflation. So how do you think that you, so do you think the 3.5% is the right number that we're getting from the government, or do you have a different opinion? I know that was a long question. What do you think?
I'm really happy you brought this up. I often wonder if the Fed board members have the equivalent of like a Fed dating app where it's like, let's match over, you know, the rates that we agree on or not. Most Americans feel the financial pain at one of two places, either at the grocery store checkout line or at the gas pump, because it's so psychologically clear because they do it so often. And the one sort of feedback, negative feedback, I might add, from clients as it relates to the cost of living over the last 2 years has been what they're paying when they leave the grocery store.
Absolutely.
Typically Costco, for example, right? Dave's killer bread used to be X, now it's X point whatever. And it's fascinating because the data provided by the Fed, call it PCE, has a number of different variables that go into that. And across the board, all of our families around the country go, we have absolutely zero faith in that number, because the number that we're seeing that's published is substantially lower than the number that we're actually seeing in terms of what we pay, right?
Yeah, I would love to be paying 3% extra on my stuff every year, but I'm not. My eggs are triple. My rent, car payments are all much more. House payments are higher. Rent payments are higher. You know, no matter where, how you, I mean, TV prices have come down a little, right? Washing machines haven't. You would think they have, right? But power bills haven't, even though we've got all this LED stuff that we've been mandated to use, and high efficiency washers and dryers, and all this extra insulation in our house, and solar and wind everywhere. But my power bill keeps going up. So, you know, I know we're talking about a few dollars when it comes to eggs, but this is where people really feel it. So you're right. People think there's a disconnect. And I think part of that disconnect, to throw it in here and I'll throw it back to you, is, you know, we used to have filet mignon in the basket of goods that the Fed used. We replaced the filet mignon with hamburger. They're like, well, it's still beef, but it's not the same, right?
Right.
Hey, it's Mark Yeagy here to tell you about our Cash Flow Machine trading program that's designed to teach you how to make safe, reliable income. Now, we shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income and growth in your portfolio. And we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of that is it only takes about 20 minutes a week to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month doesn't sound like much, I show you exactly how we took my IRA from $111,000 to over $500,000 in just 19 months without huge risk. I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io. That's cashflowmachine.io, and you can learn more.
Right. I think that's called institutional gaslighting, fly on the wall, right. Not even here. But the other variable that's come up a lot in conversations as it relates to cost is that of insurance. I'm talking 20%+ year over year for property and casualty, and even, you know, high net worth families. And everybody in the public thinks, oh, if I only had a ton of money, my life would be easy. Believe me, having money is a lot easier than not having it. But that notwithstanding, they still feel the pinch. They still feel the pain. And insurance costs have been increasing at an exorbitant rate. So all of this is fresh in people's minds. And interestingly, the providers that I use for my own house, my lawn folks, the pool folks, and so on and so on. Everyone has raised their prices. My barber, it's like everyone has been on the inflation train. And they say the cure to higher prices are higher prices, but we'll see.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. So far, not happening at all. And I have a piece of property that the insurance, it's in Florida, so that's going to tell you what I'm about to say. But the insurance is tripled, more than tripled now, in a year and a half. So, yeah, we had some hurricanes and things like that, but everything is going up. Why is it going up? I believe it's the free fiat money that we get to print, and that just drives the debasement of the dollar, which makes everybody seem like they're getting richer if they own real estate and hard assets. But at the end of the day, your house isn't worth more. Your house has a higher price, but it's still got the shelter. It's probably even a little older, but it still has the same number of bedrooms. It's not got higher value. It's just got a higher price. So that brings me to this question. And I'm really curious to see what you say about this. Are you allocating anything to Bitcoin for your clients and for your clients' clients?
I'm not, largely because either they have purchased that on their own accord for their own discretion, or because of the compliance constraints. I could be an SEC registered RIA. I choose, for many reasons, to partner with Commonwealth Financial Network as a corporate RIA. And part of the compliance there is we're essentially limited to publicly tradable securities approved on a particular platform to satisfy that. Now, I'll point out, in terms of the inflation, a lot of the clients understand purchasing power parity. That's something that we bring up in our annual, what we call partnership development meetings, or PDMs. We talk about purchasing power and the importance to keep up with that, because it's all relative. If you make 8% in a particular investment, but the inflation rate is 5, what are you really netting out with? And so we like to focus on the core net number as it relates to current dollars moving forward into the future. Many of our families own businesses, and when we look at the IRR of what they can glean from a return perspective by reinvesting in their businesses, assuming certain growth metrics are achieved, then that's a great investment, particularly as it relates to the strategies that we should implement prior to a liquidity event or potentially passing that business or multiple pieces of real estate to their heirs. But we don't go to clients and advise on specific types of cryptocurrencies to invest in.
Yeah. And I know you got your hands tied. I'm just wondering if somebody like a platform like a Commonwealth or some of these other platforms are doing a disservice to clients by not embracing at least this. I mean, it's the best performing asset in human history so far. And it's proving to be something that's not a Ponzi scheme so far in 15 years. I wonder if, we look back 15, 20 years from now and go, wow, we really kind of did a disservice by not at least exploring and opening that up and making it available. Because now there are 9 ETFs that are Bitcoin-based that are publicly traded. So you don't have to weigh in that. So you'll get in trouble. But,
No, I like to avoid getting in trouble.
Yeah.
It's funny. So as it relates to the publicly traded, I'll call them cryptocurrency related options that are on a platform, if it's approved, then clients can purchase it through us.
Sure.
But again, most of the clients who have been on the crypto train, that party started years ago, and they already had those investments individually. And if they fall outside of our purview, and obviously E&O policy, we just go, hey, can't talk about this. Here's why. They totally understand, and it's a non-issue.
So there are, the typical financial advisor, and I used to be one, so I put myself in that category back then. We allocate assets into a nice portfolio of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and ETFs, maybe with a little gold in there. And we try to get a return that's kind of smooth. When the markets are going up, it's smoothly going up. And when it's going down, it's smoothly not dropping as much as if you were overexposed to one asset class. So what alternative asset classes do you offer that maybe provide something a little different off the beaten path than your typical financial advisor?
We have a full platform of alternative investments. managed futures, long short equity, merger arbitrage, and so forth. And having spent 10 years, almost 10 years, in that space, I'm deeply familiar with the strategies, the historical return streams, and so forth. But when we're investing the liquid portion of a portfolio, again, as sort of a macro thinker, we look at the entirety of the estate. Many of our families own real estate and or a business. So when I look at the historical return stream of those two aforementioned items, I have to account for that in terms of the need or lack thereof of alternative investments within a liquid portfolio. And ultimately, as you know, and I'm sort of preaching to the choir here, each client is different. Their investment objectives are different.
Of course.
Coming off of 2 years of double-digit up performance in equities, a lot of people are sitting there going, well, wait a minute. If the S&P is up 20 and I'm up 15, am I really keeping up with the market? Why is that?
Right.
Of course, we have the typical conversation of understanding what goes into the index. Are you actually comfortable being over-allocated to tech or heavily weighted to the tech names that have really driven the substantial majority of that performance? And Mark, there are clients that are very much in that bucket. They're okay with having the volatility. It just depends on the comfort level.
Right, right. And one of the reasons I'm not a broker anymore or a financial advisor is because when I gave them the idea and the stock went up, they kind of took ownership of the idea and said, yeah, I kind of agree with you. But when it goes down, you're the son of a bitch to put me into this investment, right? So you're the guy. You're totally responsible. So I was like, that's kind of thankless. But you know, that's the way investing goes. It's really the same thing at all levels of investing, whether you're doing hedge funds like I do, or whether you're doing retail stuff like I used to do. So, so you have a book out, right?
So I authored Fiduciary Wealth Management, which is subtitled A Millionaire's Guide to Choosing the Right Financial Advisor, which is a 13-page PDF. It's a simple read, but it curates all of the must-know information for either a retail or high net worth or even ultra high net worth profile to understand what key questions to ask of their current advisor or one they're considering hiring. And then secondarily, the key things to know so that they don't get 10 years into the future and turn around and go, wow, if only I had known that I can do tax loss harvesting and donate different types of appreciated securities to charity via a donor advised fund or a charitable remainder trust, and on and on and on, ultimately to keep as much money in that estate and to move forward in transferring their assets to their heirs as tax efficiently as possible.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. So let's let everybody know how to get that, because that sounds like a good read and an easy read, 13 pages, but probably a wealth of information. How do people find that? We'll also put it in the show notes if you're driving around listening to us.
So they can either Google Vance Barse and go to the YDF website or the Vance Barse website. I do a fair amount of financial media and lecturing, and am very appreciative of the relationship I have with the Fourth Estate. And there are submission forms, very easy, takes 30 seconds or less. And as soon as we receive that, then we go ahead and email it to the profile, as long as they're not another financial advisor.
I'm sure you're getting some people that are skirting around that too, but yeah. Good. Well, that's cool. So listen, anything that I didn't ask you that I should have asked you that we should talk about?
Ask me in 6 months and I'll tell you.
Okay, so I won't have you make any predictions unless you want to make predictions about the market or the economy or whatever, so that I can't do any gotchas in 6 months. Fair enough?
Fair enough. I think that it's really important for investors to understand that even folks at the Fed can really only predict 3 to 6 months out. I'm very fortunate to have relationships with some current and former Fed presidents and see them in New York when I visit for the Fed meetings. Obviously the Fed meets in DC, but all the action happens in New York City. And offline they'll share that, look, we can really only go 3 to 6 months out. No one knows where inflation is going to be 12 months from now. We do our best guess. We try to get there. But I think that the Fed really has its work cut out for it based on all of the things we've discussed today and the fact that the economy structurally is different. And I'm along for the ride. We'll see what happens.
Exactly. I love it. I love it. Well, I think we're kind of I think the Fed has really painted themselves in the corner. We're in an inflationary spiral because of the high debt that we have. And unless we can get the debt down, I think we're going to see more of the same. But, you know, like you said, 3 to 6 months, a year from now, we'll see if any of that holds true. Vance, thank you so much for being the best part of Wealth Architect Podcast, and appreciate your time, your wisdom, and thanks for being here.
Mark, thank you so much. It's truly been a pleasure.
Yeah, and everybody else who's listening and watching, remember what I always say. Never give up your power in your health, your wealth, or your time. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for your time, and I'll see you next time. Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect Podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.